This is sort of an overview of work that I've been involved in for the better part of a decade with a variety of people, but Coral Gardner is a key person, as we'll see, who's been involved in this work, which is why she's a co-author on this paper. So I've been reporting on a series of studies, and was explaining to, I think it was Jim McCambridge earlier today, that this is sort of a rational reconstruction of the logic that underlie the work that we did. It didn't seem as rational as it will seem in the presentation I've given today. So the question we started out with originally back in 2003-04 was, how can we go about getting the prevalence of cigarette smoking in Australia down under 10%, which was the goal set by the Australian government? As it seemed to us at the time that Simon Chapman, who was a colleague who worked with us on that grant, had pointed out that when he got into the tobacco control area, his wish list of tobacco control policies had largely been implemented and had driven the prevalence of smoking down. What more could be done to get it lower? Our original focus, and a fair part of what I'll talk about, is in the first of these, I've called high technology approaches, and a lot of these came out of the Human Genome Project and the very optimistic predictions of people like Francis Collins and others about what the decoding of the human genome would enable us to do in genomic medicine, was the phrase that he used. So we're particularly interested in applications of a lot of research on the genetics of nicotine dependence and its application in prevention and targeting treatment to individual smokers who wanted to quit. The other topic that was around as early as 2001 was the really neat idea that we could vaccinate smokers against nicotine molecules, initially with the intention of helping smokers quit. But of course, you talk about a vaccine and the first thing people want to think about is using it preventatively. So we spent a fair amount of time looking at these two, and I'll talk about that. Now, I guess we became aware in the course of this that these approaches may well make a difference, but it was likely to be a fairly modest at best and probably marginal difference to the prevalence of cigarette smoking. And became interested in the debate, which has long raged in the tobacco control community, about tobacco harm reduction, which we've described as low technology, and as I'll say later, is really back to the 18th and 19th century, turning the clock back to methods of tobacco use before the cigarette dominated, came to conquer the method of tobacco use in most developed countries. And the final approach I'll look at is what I've described as the no technology approach. There's no technology involved other than, you know, the ancient technology of the law, where we legislate to ban smoked tobacco products, which is what some people in the tobacco control community are now advocating. So a bit of background on Australia, and Australia is often held up as an example of the success of tobacco control policies, and I think for good reason. We've got prevalence now in adults down under around the 20% mark. In fact, recent surveys, the number of daily smokers in some states is as low as 15 and 16%. So we've driven the prevalence of smoking down, particularly over the last several decades, and we know that the major factors that have driven that down have been, first and foremost, taxation increases, which since 1992 have been levied at per stick, and as I'll show you in the next graph, that's gone up steadily over time. There's been a steep increase very recently, which is probably responsible for the recent drop in smoking prevalence. We've banned all advertising and promotion of cigarette products for quite a long time, and we're amongst the first in the world to introduce fairly tight restrictions on smoking in workplaces in the late 80s and across public places, bars, pubs and clubs in the 1990s and early 2000s. And these policies have been put in place across the country to good effect. So this is the evidence on tobacco taxation. As you can see, that as the cost of tobacco got up, adjusted for CPI, has risen, the prevalence of use of tobacco products has gone down. And you can see the fairly the recent steep increase in taxation in 2010 has contributed to declining prevalence. So what more can we do to get this prevalence down under 10%, which is a figure plucked out of the air by government, a nice round number that we should aim at. The US government have set a similar sort of target. We've often asked where that's come from, and the best that people can do is to say, well, that's the prevalence you've got under 10% prevalence of smoking in physicians and others, and the best informed part of the population, and we reasonably expect that we could do that across the whole population. Well, the limiting factors are the so-called hardening of remaining smokers, and I won't talk in detail about that. We've done quite a bit of work looking at the extent to which that's happening. It doesn't appear to be an increase in nicotine dependence because the average number of cigarettes smoked per smoker has gone down over time, largely as a consequence of the reduced opportunities to smoke. The hardening has tended to occur more in social disadvantage, so smokers are more socially disadvantaged, and also risk-exempting beliefs that remaining smokers are quite prepared to concede that smoking is bad for people in general, but for some reason those sorts of concerns don't apply to them. Sort of there's risk-exempting beliefs that seem to be common amongst heavy smokers who continue to smoke. We're not fabulously successful in getting people to quit. The cessation treatments on offer are more effective than placebo, but not by a lot. We still have the tobacco industry countervailing efforts to market their products, particularly through social media. And there's also, particularly in government, been a view that the problem's been addressed. You know, we've done what we can for tobacco control. The community is well informed, so if people continue to choose to smoke, that's an informed adult choice. There's nothing more that we can do about it. And as we'll see later on in the case of tobacco harm reduction, there's strong opposition to even contemplating or discussing those policies within the tobacco control community in Australia. I think there's much more opposition there than there is here, although I know there is opposition here as well. So the three types of approaches that we looked at were, as I mentioned, the high-tech, low-tech and no-tech approaches. And we spent probably too long on the first of these, but I'll talk about some of the work we did there. So this is work arising out of genomic medicine and nicotine vaccines. And there was good reason to be pursuing work in this domain because there was very compelling evidence that genetic factors were implicated in nicotine dependence. There's a lot of evidence from twin studies and adoption studies that there's a substantial genetic contribution to whether people initiate smoking, and probably a more substantial genetic contribution to whether people persist in smoking and hence become regular smokers. And so the idea was if we could identify the bases of the genetic bases of those forms of nicotine dependence, we could do two sorts of things: preventive use of that information, that is, identify individuals at increased risk of developing nicotine dependence or particular tobacco-related diseases and advise them to quit smoking. And in fact, that was an example given by Francis Collins in an influential article in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1999. The other potential use has been more in the therapeutic domain, where we're looking at people who wanted to quit smoking. We could genotype them and target to them, or identify the form of treatment for smoking cessation that was most likely to be effective for them. We could also attempt to develop more effective cessation treatments, and the nicotine vaccine is that's where that comes in. And I'll talk about the potential preventive use of that approach. First, a very quick reprise of the genetics of smoking. As I mentioned, the twin and adoption studies show substantial heritability for initiation and persistence. But the challenge had been until very recently that the attempt to identify specific alleles or genes that would underlie that genetic contribution had been frustrated by publication bias and failure to replicate effects. That's changed in the last 4 or 5 years, largely as a consequence of meta-analyses of large-scale case control studies using genome-wide association study methods. And there's now pretty consistent evidence from Europe and North America that there's a region on chromosome 15 which is implicated in nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, which is where nicotine acts in the central nervous system, and also, probably not quite as consistently, but reasonably consistent, that genes that control the way in which individuals metabolize nicotine influence the liability to become nicotine dependent if people smoke. But the thing about most of these findings is that the strength of the relationship between having one of these genotypes and being a smoker is still pretty weak. If you have the particular genotype that's been most consistently identified and you smoke, then you're about 1.12 times to 1.31 times more likely than somebody who doesn't have that genotype to become nicotine dependent. So as colleagues in public health describe these sorts of relative risks rather contemptuously as decimal dust, you wouldn't get excited about relative risks of this sort when you're talking about environmental exposures, for example. And if you look at a measure such as the number of cigarettes per day, the average difference between people who have these high-risk alleles and those who don't, who smoke, is about one cigarette per day. So we're not talking about incredibly potent effects here, but they are have been consistently replicated. One of the things we did was to look at the feasibility of this sort of high-risk prevention strategy. And we suspected that this was unlikely to be an effective approach because we're talking about large numbers of susceptibility genes. High-risk combinations would be relatively rare in the population. And so if you screened whole populations, for most people, you'd be telling them you're at average risk. And so that's what we expected to find. Carl Gartner, Jan Barendrecht and I did some modelling back in 2008 where we did a meta-analysis of the most promising polymorphisms at the time that had been identified as correlated with susceptibility to develop nicotine dependence. And I should say that it's interesting that this list that we put together in 2007 and 2008 doesn't contain any of the genes that have subsequently been replicated, and none of these ones are in the current list of susceptibility alleles for nicotine dependence. I think that's just reflecting the fact that back then the field was fairly immature, large numbers of studies with small samples that with lots of publication bias. But as you can see with the relative risks, you're talking about very modest relative risks of just above, barely above one. So what we asked was the question, could you use combinations of these genotypes to predict likelihood of becoming nicotine dependent? And the obvious way and what people have been doing is basically adding up the number of these risk alleles that an individual had and seeing if that predicted. We also asked the question, well, what would be the obvious comparator here if you're looking at screening populations? So we thought of a very low-tech form of quasi-genetic information, which was how many of your parents smoked, 0, 1 or 2. And we did some modelling, simulating populations. You generate, construct a population and repeatedly sample from it and construct. You end up constructing a receiver operating characteristic which curve which looks at the performance of screening tests. And of course the chance line here is the diagonal, so that's if you toss a coin. And what you can see here is neither of these tests do a very good job. The area under the curve in both cases is only modestly greater than chance, but the number of parents who smoked did marginally better than the score on the genetic risk factor there. We then went on to ask, well, okay, that's the genes that are available now. What if we had a lot more genes? We're able to identify a lot more genotypes and we could specify the characteristics, the relative risks and the prevalence of these genotypes that would produce, that might well produce screening tests that were adequate. And what you discover is that basically screening tests that are in the sort of range that would be regarded as acceptable are shown in yellow, and you'd have to have at least 20 genotypes, and you'd still be looking at relative risks up in the 1.8 to 2. Which is not where most of these studies, in fact, most of the relative risks, including the more recent ones, have been down in this sort of range here, 1.2 or less. And in fact, just very recently, in the last month, there's been a study published from the Dunedin birth cohort, which is a birth cohort of about 1,000 here in New Zealand. People who've been studied now to age 38 and been genotyped. Dan Bielski and colleagues have just published this paper, and they also had very detailed information on smoking history. So this is a truly a longitudinal prediction of likelihood of becoming a smoker. And what they looked at was they calculated a genetic risk score, very much along the lines of what we've just described in our modelling, and they wanted to see to what extent that genetic risk score, which is the number of how many of 12 risk alleles a person was positive on, whether that predicted their adolescent smoking trajectory, that is whether they started smoking or not, if they started when they moved to daily smoking, and then whether either of these predicted adult smoking outcomes, that is development of nicotine dependence, a long history of fast cessation, and number of pack years smoked. And the genetic risk score did in fact predict these outcomes, but again, very, very modestly, you're talking about a correlation between the risk score and number of cigarettes per day of about 0.10. There's a very modest correlation, and the relative risks were in the range of 1.1 to 1.4 for the outcomes of nicotine dependence and a history of failed quit attempts. And as I'd said earlier, as we predicted, the average number of these risk alleles that anyone in the population had was 8. So you ended up with a log normal distribution slightly skewed to the right, in which most of the sample ended up being at average risk. And if you calculate an ROC curve, you find that the area under the curve is in the sort of region of a fairly poor screening test. So I think this is a very direct test of what we attempted to get at with our modelling, and tends to confirm that risk prediction, or genetic risk screening in the population, is not very effective. And there'd be a lot of people doing work on the genetics of nicotine dependence who wouldn't be surprised by that. In fact, they'd be a bit surprised that anyone would propose you'd screen whole populations, but there are people around who do that. There's been much more interest in the second possibility, which is using genetic information to tailor cessation treatment to individual smokers. So the rationale being that smokers differ in genetic background, and they also differ in treatment outcome and response. And if the genomic information predicts differential treatment response, we could use that genomic information to tell people which form of smoking cessation was most likely to be useful for them. And in fact, there was a test marketed in the UK back in the mid-2000s, Nicotest, which purported to do exactly this, using the dopamine DRD2 allele to triage smokers into nicotine replacement or Zyban. But the evaluations of that just didn't support the claims made, and the tests were subsequently withdrawn from the market. So there has been interest in using the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor alleles that have been more consistently identified. And there, again, there's been a sort of a replication of the familiar experience of small studies producing promising results which have not been replicated in larger studies. And most recently, there's just been a very large GWAS meta-analysis published using four European samples which looked at the most promising candidates, genetic candidates for predictors of ease or difficulty of quitting, and they just weren't unable to find any of these that were useful in the sample. So this doesn't look terribly promising as an approach either. So the approaches that people in the business are looking at more are less about trying to tailor treatment to individuals on the basis of genotype than attempting to improve both the uptake of cessation aids, because one of the things that still remains the case is that the great majority of smokers who are interested in quitting don't use these aids. They typically attempt to quit without assistance. But although most people who succeed in quitting quit that way, the great majority of people who attempt to quit without assistance fail to do so. And although we've made these forms of treatment more available over the counter in most developed countries, the study suggests that smokers don't use them long enough to get any benefit from them. And so the critics, Simon Chapman and others, have noted that the results of nicotine replacement in the wild, as it were, are nowhere near as good as the results of nicotine replacement in clinical trials. So we need to improve uptake and compliance with these forms of treatment, and that might involve looking at forms of sustained release and implantable drugs that don't require people to comply on a daily basis, which is what they tend not to be very good at. There's also great potential for repurposing old drugs. There's a whole variety of drugs that have already been approved for other indications that are out of patent, that are quite cheap, that act on the cholinergic neurotransmitters in ways that might be useful in smoking. And so the suggestion has been we probably should be doing more work in that area in attempting to improve the outcome of smoking cessation. The other approach I mentioned earlier, nicotine vaccines, which is a really cool idea, which has got people very excited, and it's been seen as a very promising idea for at least 10 years that I'm aware of. And the reason why people get excited about it is there are some pretty compelling animal models demonstrating proof of principle that you can, in fact, raise antibodies against a nicotine molecule by linking it with various proteins. And then in animal models, the vaccination against nicotine prevents it from crossing the blood-brain barrier, and it will abolish self-administration of nicotine in rats, and will in fact stop the release of dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, the so-called reward centre in the brain. So there's a lot of compelling preclinical evidence that this might be an approach of value, and for a long time, for the better part of the last decade, there have been at least three companies involved in actively developing and trialling nicotine vaccines for smoking cessation. The problem has been, as is evident in this, the largest of these, the clinical trials that have been published to date, is it's been very difficult to produce high enough levels of immunity in human smokers to produce the sort of efficacy seen in animal models. So in this study, it took 5 injections of the vaccine over the period of a month to produce a level of immunity, and at 6 months the proportion of people who achieved abstinence was no different between placebo and vaccine, marginally higher in the vaccine but not statistically significant. But in the group, the minority, about a third of those who'd been vaccinated who did produce high levels of antibody titer, they did show much higher rates of abstinence, so almost over half. So the challenge has been, and in fact this company, I think, and several others are no longer developing nicotine vaccines because of the lack of the difficulty in producing requisite levels of immune response in individual smokers. There's been more recent animal evidence suggesting that you can use monoclonal antibodies in the same sort of way, but that's a much more expensive technology, and it's doubtful that companies will be prepared to invest the sort of money required to do that, particularly when it's much simpler and more straightforward to be looking at pharmaceutical drugs such as varenicline. But the idea dies hard, and one of the ideas that recurrently appears in the media, and is in fact to be found on the websites of several of the companies producing or trialling nicotine vaccines, is that one day it will be possible to vaccinate all adolescents and basically end smoking as a problem. And it's a fairly seductive idea and simplicity itself. One of the things that Coral Gartner, Jan Baradrift and Angela Wallace and I did was to model the first of these possibilities. Would it make sense to universally vaccinate all young people against nicotine? Would this be likely to be a cost-effective approach? I won't go into the ethical details. I mean, the ethicists are often running and debating the ethics of whether we should be doing this. We wanted to answer the question as to whether it's ever likely that we would do it, which is what we're looking at, the cost effectiveness. So we did some modelling of the sort that's fairly common in Britain and Australia when decisions are made about whether drugs should be publicly subsidised. So we assumed that the vaccine would show the same sort of efficacy in some of the earlier trials, and stress that the earlier trials were a bit more positive than the recent ones, which are more negative. And we attempted to model the impact that vaccinating a whole birth cohort would have on smoking rates in young adults, varying across plausible ranges the proportion of the cohort who were vaccinated, the cost of the vaccine, and the proportion of people who'd be adherent enough to complete the vaccination schedule. And we calculated the standard ISA, which is beloved of health economists and pharmaceutical regulatory authorities, as a measure of the effect of this particular approach. And what we discovered is this would be a fabulously expensive and not very effective way of preventing nicotine addiction in the population. So even for the sorts of the most optimistic assumption, which is this blue curve down here, if we assume that everybody who was vaccinated completed the full course of the vaccination schedule, you're looking at a cost per smoker averted, which is probably about 10 to 20 times higher than the cost of other public health interventions. If we're looking at it in terms of DALYs averted, again, we end up, these are Australian dollars. In the Australian pharmaceutical regulatory system, we typically tend not to subsidise drugs or vaccines that cost more than $50,000 per DALY averted. So even the most optimistic of case, we're assuming everybody vaccinated completed the schedule and it was low cost, we're still well outside the range of a product that would be subsidised by the Australian government. And if you look at the total cost of this, we'd be looking at over $1 billion. We have been prepared to spend that money for human papillomavirus prevention, but I think the case there is much better documented, much better evidence of efficacy. So when we were becoming disillusioned with the high-tech approach is when we started to pay attention to the low-technology options, back to the 18th and 19th centuries, when the great majority of nicotine users didn't smoke. They either chewed tobacco or used snuff, or if they did smoke, it was pipes and cigars rather than cigarettes, and they didn't inhale. And so the issue here is whether we should attempt to engineer a return to these forms of nicotine use in the case of current smokers who are either unable or unwilling to quit, encourage them to adopt non-smoke methods of nicotine delivery. And the candidates here are obviously nicotine replacement products, nicotine gum, patches and inhalers, or older products such as smokeless tobacco, snuff and chewing tobacco. And I'll come to the electronic or e-cigarettes because I think what's happened is that the tobacco control field has been a bit distracted with, as we'll see, have spent a lot of time debating tobacco harm reduction using smokeless tobacco when the questions have been replaced by what our attitude should be to these newer methods of delivery, so-called e-cigarettes or electronic cigarettes. So here's a bit of history from Alan Brandt's book, The Cigarette Century. This is, don't have any data on the 18th century, but this is 19th century data just making the point that the cigarette is really a phenomenon of the last century, sort of really taking off at the beginning of the 20th and dominating the tobacco market in the US through the middle 50s and thereafter. As you can see, there was a big component of tobacco use in the US was either chewing or snuff, and the rest was pipe, roll your own, or cigars. So the question is whether we should attempt to engineer a return, particularly to these forms of administration that don't involve the combustion of tobacco smoke. So the most promising options that people have talked about have been clean, so-called clean pharmaceutical nicotine, or low nitrosamine smokeless tobacco, which is a form of tobacco product used mainly in Scandinavia. It's been pasteurised effectively to kill the bacteria that produce nitrosamines, which are one of the nasty carcinogens in chewed tobacco. The problem has been, particularly with the pharmaceutical nicotine, is these products are designed as short-term cessation aids, so they're not really attractive. Most smokers don't find them as a plausible alternative for long-term use to tobacco. So the advocates of this particular approach have tended to rely on experience in Sweden, where low nitrosamine smokeless tobacco has been very readily taken up by Swedish men and has produced steep declines both in smoking in Swedish men and in tobacco-related disease. And I guess this is sort of like a sociological proof of principle that it is possible in some circumstances to persuade a population of smokers to make the move away from smoke to non-smoke forms of tobacco. So the case for low nitrosamine smokeless tobacco as a form of harm reduction, I think, is particularly compelling because there's quite a lot of good epidemiological evidence from Sweden on the health risks of this particular form of tobacco use. We know that it eliminates the respiratory risks, the chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and lung cancer. It's very, very substantially reduces the risks of oral cancer, which are fairly substantial for more traditional forms of chewed tobacco. And it may or may not have residual cardiovascular disease risks. There's a bit of uncertainty about that from the longitudinal studies. But the best guess from people knowledgeable about this is that you reduce the health risks of tobacco use by 80 to 90% if you switch from smoking to tobacco to using this nitrosamine, low nitrosamine smokeless tobacco. So that would be clearly a huge benefit to be had from this particular approach. The catch, of course, is what impact this sort of move might have on population use of tobacco products, and there's been quite a bit of arguing about that, as we'll see. So just briefly, the Swedish experience has been a big increase in uptake of these products, particularly in Swedish men, much lower rates of use amongst Swedish women. And the reason being, I gather, that these products traditionally are pretty yucky. They're sort of black, tarry tobacco product that's put in the mouth between the lip and the gum, and the nicotine's absorbed through the oral mucosa. They've attempted to market these sort of forms of tea bags as a more attractive form of use for women. I don't know that it's proven a lot more successful, but an unintended consequence of the fact that it's men rather than women that take this product up is you've got a control population in Scandinavia that you're able to sort of show that rates of smoking have declined much faster in Swedish men than women. There's no evidence of increased uptake of smokers, that is, of young people starting to use snus and becoming cigarette smokers, because most of the traffic is from cigarette smoking to snus use. And the health consequences have been fairly substantial benefits in reductions in male lung cancer rates, while female lung cancer rates have not changed, and there's been no apparent increases in rates of oral cancer, although there's been some increase in pancreatic cancer in males who use these particular products. And as I mentioned earlier, some uncertainty about the cardiovascular disease risk. One of the things we did in 2007, Coral Gardner and a variety of other colleagues, was to model the health gains in healthy adjusted life expectancy that would accrue to smokers who quit, compare the gain in healthy adjusted life expectancy in smokers who quit with that in smokers who switched to snus. And we also modelled the impact of continuing to smoke. So the benchmark here was that if you, at age 35, if you quit smoking, you'd gain around about 8 years of healthy adjusted life expectancy. And conversely, if you continue to smoke, you'd lose about 8 years of healthy adjusted life expectancy. I think the usual figure is about 10 years of life expectancy, healthy adjusted life expectancy, adjusts for the fact that the last couple of years of life are often not quite as good quality as the earlier ones. And what we found is that the difference between quitting and switching to snus was fairly small over that life expectancy. You'd lose about 0.1 to 0.4 years in life expectancy for men and women. So if you just look at this as sort of a survival curve, years of healthy life for male and female snus users and those who quit. So you're so clearly better off to quit. You consistently gain more life expectancy, although the gain decreases very clearly the later you quit, unsurprisingly. And this is true for men and women. So there's clearly substantial gains to be had for smokers who make that particular change. So why don't we encourage this? Well, in Europe, Britain and Australia, I think everywhere except the US and Canada, smokeless tobacco products are banned. We don't allow smokers to make that particular choice. And so we face the challenge of persuading regulatory authorities to reverse the ban. And what we see in the tobacco control community are debates about the wisdom of advocating this particular policy. And I'll just briefly go through some of these. I think a very common underlying objection, particularly in the case of people in the tobacco control community, is the view that our goal should be the elimination of all tobacco use, regardless of route of administration. And people who argue this argue that smokeless tobacco is harmful and addictive, and for some of them it's the addiction that's the central objection to this particular approach. We've argued in a couple of papers that this is, I think, a morally problematic view of the world, that you're continuing to allow the most harmful products to be readily available and deny smokers access to products that would very, very substantially reduce their risks. And you have to ask the question, how realistic is it that we're ever going to get to zero tobacco use as a public health goal? In fact, we also modelled, predicted the future prevalence of tobacco smoking in Australia, and very similar models have been done in the US. And at best, we'd still be looking at 10% or more of adult smoking in 2025. So the idea that we just keep doing more of the same and smoking's going to disappear, I think, is an optimistic view. Clearly, the logical implication of this view of the goals of tobacco policy is that we should move towards the prohibition of all tobacco products. And that's an argument that we'll return to later. The second concern has been about the population health impact. Okay, individual smokers who make the switch from smoking tobacco to using smokeless tobacco benefit. But what if this was offset by adverse impacts on the prevalence of smoking? What if the availability of these products deterred smokers from quitting or encouraged former smokers to resume use? Or if these products served as a gateway to smoking? Young people initiated with smokeless tobacco and then became tobacco smokers, the argument being that if any of these sorts of scenarios were to occur, the benefits that individual smokers might get from making the switch could be offset at a population level. Well, we also did some modelling of how plausible these sorts of scenarios were, and Lynn Kozlowski had made pretty much the same point in a paper more from a much simpler analysis, but arriving at the same conclusion. And basically, the story is you have to have a lot of ex-smokers to take up snus to offset the benefit from a single smoker switching from smoking to snus. And you'd have to have a hell of a lot of people who'd never smoked taking up snus, largely because the difference in risk is so vast between smoking and snus use. So the major uncertainties are really about this sort of gateway effect. And the Swedish experience doesn't support that, although there's a bit more mixed evidence in the US. The third set of objections has been, well, that's Sweden, that's not going to work elsewhere. They've got a peculiar history of the use of these particular products that's unlikely to be replicated in other countries. To which I think the answer is, well, why worry? If people don't take it up, it's not going to happen, not going to cause any harm. Well, the critics seem to want to argue two things which I think are inconsistent. One, that smokers won't have any interest in these products. The only people who try them will be non-smokers, and they'll be in a great hurry to switch from smokeless tobacco to smoking cigarettes. Those are the sorts of things that would have to happen. I think they're pretty implausible, given what we know in Sweden. The fourth concern, I think, is a real one, and it's what the tobacco industry would do with these products to undermine the effectiveness of tobacco control. And these aren't theoretical possibilities because we know from the US that they're already doing this. In the US it's possible to sell and promote smokeless tobacco. So the US companies, tobacco industry, have bought smokeless tobacco companies and market smokeless tobacco with the same brand names as smoked tobacco, and they encourage people to use them. When you can't smoke, use snus. And so they're encouraging dual use in an effort to undermine the impact of smoking bans so that smokers can persist. So there is a concern here, but I don't think this is insurmountable. I think there are regulatory ways that one could prevent that, and the simplest one would be to ban the marketing of smokeless tobacco products using the same brand names as cigarettes. But that can't happen in the US because that would be infringements of commercial free speech and various other things of that sort. So I guess we've got an interesting experiment going on in the US to see how this works out. But as I said earlier, while the tobacco control community has been arguing about the pros and cons of smokeless tobacco, we've largely been caught by surprise by enormous interest among smokers, particularly here in Britain and also in Australia, in e-cigarettes. These are electronic cigarettes that have been marketed. I think the products were developed in China in the early 2000s, and they involve heating either tobacco itself or nicotine, and in combination with a vapor that people inhale. So you're not inhaling tar and particulate matter, you're inhaling nicotine in a vapor, typically a water or glycoline acetal base. Almost certainly less harmful than cigarettes, although less clear by how much. And they look like, and they're used like cigarettes, people puff on them, and some of them have sort of bright red lights that light up when you're puffing, so it's a bit like smoking cigarettes. And there's enormous interest in them, and quite a bit of uptake. I think most recent figures I've heard, about 500,000 smokers in the UK have already tried these products. And there's a lot of debate about what should we do about them. So in a sense, the debate about whether we should or shouldn't reverse bans on smokeless tobacco has really been bypassed by the development of these particular products which are already on the marketplace. As I understand, the regulatory authority here in Britain is to make a ruling very very soon about what its attitude towards these products ought to be. So what are the options? How should we respond? Well, in Australia, we just banned them preemptively, and so other countries have done. And I think it's a silly and draconian policy. And there's good reason to be concerned about these products, good reason to attempt to minimise the way they're promoted, strong reasons for wanting to evaluate their safety and concerns about that. But a ban doesn't seem to me to be a particularly appropriate policy to go. It's, again, perpetuating the perverse regulatory incentive in that we're prepared to allow the most dangerous products to be freely marketed and banning the use of less dangerous forms of product. And it's also unclear how much governments are prepared to enforce these bans. That's becoming an issue in Australia. We've effectively prohibited these, but there clearly is lots of trade. There are people promoting the products, there are people using them, there are black markets developing. And if you ban it, it's harder to assess what's going on. You don't know how much is being sold, you don't know who's using it, you don't know what the issues are. So if you ban it, the only way in which it could be made available is to put it through the pharmaceutical regulatory process as a cessation aid, and regulate it in the same way as you do for nicotine replacement. British American Tobacco are doing that here, I gather, with an electronic cigarette that they've purchased. Coral Gardner has been funded to do a trial of e-cigarettes for smoking cessation in Australia, so we're about to embark on a trial of that. That's a fairly protracted process. It could be years in the making, but it may well be the only way it gets up in Australia. But if we don't ban it, and we allow smokers to use it, how might we go about minimising some of the adverse effects of its uptake? Well, I'd be in favour of allowing their use and limited sale, and we've in fact editorialised along these lines in the Medical Journal of Australia, suggesting that the sale of these sorts of products might be put in the hands of cancer charities who have less of an interest in increasing and marketing, increasing the market for use and promoting them to young people, that anyone who wants to get into the business of manufacturing and marketing these products ought to be prepared to put money up or to pay some sort of levy that would be used to fund the sort of research required to assess the quality of these products and critically to look at the evaluation of their short-term and long-term safety. And clearly we'd need to be monitoring sales and use of these products, particularly by young people. And we've argued that we should be seeing the advent of these products as really a game changer in lots of ways, as creating an opportunity for increased regulation of cigarettes. It's one of the big problems we've had in regulating cigarettes. How do you regulate a commodity which is incredibly harmful? Well, here you've got a commodity that smokers are interested in using that's probably a lot less harmful than smoking cigarettes and probably could be made even less harmful with appropriate engineering and quality control that would provide a justification for screwing down on the availability of the most harmful forms of cigarettes. And so we could attempt to increase the uptake of the least harmful products and reduce the availability of the most harmful. I'll finish off by talking about no-tech options, and I'll return to the tobacco harm reduction because I think I'll argue that the combination of increased availability of less harmful forms of tobacco with more restrictive policies towards smoked tobacco is probably the way we should be going. I won't talk about plain packaging of cigarettes. I'm happy to answer questions on that. I think that's one of the more interesting policy experiments that's underway in Australia. Too early to tell what its effect will be, but potentially it could be quite an effective policy. I won't talk about regulating cigarette content in great detail, except the proposal that Robert Proctor and others have put up that we regulate cigarette content in ways that make it very difficult for people to smoke. And I'll talk about the desirability of reducing tobacco, smoked tobacco availability, particularly in convenience stores. So the proposal that was first floated, I think about 15 years ago, by Jack Henningfield and others, was that government should regulate nicotine content of cigarettes and progressively reduce it to zero over a 10 to 15 year period. So that smokers, cigarettes wouldn't contain enough nicotine to sustain smoking as a habit. And the argument for doing it gradually is that smokers, if the reduction in average nicotine yield was gradual enough, smokers wouldn't notice it as much as if you abruptly reduced it. It would also enable the tobacco industry to gradually get out of the smoked tobacco business. Robert Proctor, in his Golden Holocaust, has added the suggestion, again going backwards, is one of the things that made the smoked tobacco cigarette feasible and attractive to smokers was the bright tobacco, the development of tobacco that was easy to inhale. And so what Proctor's saying is we should restrict the production of tobacco, cigarette tobacco, to the forms of tobacco that were really unpleasant and difficult and aversive when people inhaled them. So it'd be much more like cigars than tobacco smoke. And that this could be done in a regulatory way, as it could in the US, because the Food and Drug Administration has been given the authority to regulate tobacco along these lines. So if we're to do that, and we could combine that with, as I mentioned earlier, progressively restricting the venues where cigarettes were sold, increasing taxes on the most harmful products, reducing taxes on less harmful products, and probably making e-cigarettes more available than smoked cigarettes would be one way to go. One has to anticipate the obvious side effects of what would amount to de facto prohibition on smoked tobacco, and assuming the best case that we had about 10% of adults still smoking daily, we'd have a pretty substantial black market, potential for a black market there. And in fact, we'd have a black market larger than the current black market for cannabis in a country like Australia. So we'd have 10% of people smoking tobacco daily, as against 10% of people who've used cannabis in the past year. And this would be a fairly profitable market to service. And in fact, we've already got a reasonable black market in Australia because of the high rates of taxation. We've got smuggling of legal tobacco products in from Pacific countries, and we've also even got small-scale illicit production of tobacco and its sale. We'd also anticipate that this form of black market would probably be more targeted at poorer smokers, so it probably would go towards amplifying social inequities in smoking prevalence, and the poorer smokers would continue to use the most harmful of these products, and probably a lot of the marketing these tobacco products, as with the marketing of illicit drugs, would tend to occur in poorer areas. Well, we can also think of ways in which we could mitigate these side effects, and I think the obvious way of mitigating them is making more readily available other forms of nicotine and encouraging people to switch from the most harmful to less harmful forms of it. And so we've proposed a sort of phased implementation of these sorts of policy experiments. And obviously the first of these is to try and evaluate forms of tobacco harm reduction as smoking cessation approaches, either as a second line treatment after nicotine replacement, and if people are unable to quit, then at least persuading them to switch to using tobacco harm reduction products rather than smoke cigarettes. This could be done in combination with liberalised regulation of these products and allowing restricted sale of e-cigarettes for inveterate smokers, and clearly rigorously evaluating the impact that these policies have. So just a quick sum up. High-tech tobacco control futures, genetic risk screening is not likely to be useful. There may be some contribution from pharmacogenomics, it's still early days, but I'd still bet on a greater return from improved uptake of existing treatments and development of more effective cessation drugs. Forget about preventive vaccination, I think. I think where the action's likely to be in terms of substantial public health benefit is in the area of tobacco harm reduction. I think it's a strong moral case for making less harmful products available for people who want to use tobacco. There are uncertainties, as the critics have noted, about public health impacts, and we need to be very carefully monitoring the impact of these policies and probably doing it in an incremental way. But the major obstacle to that, particularly in Australia, I think less so in the UK, is the strong opposition from within the tobacco control community to tobacco harm reduction as an approach. And in the case where you've already banned these products, as we have in Australia, it's much harder to overturn a prohibition than it is to argue against a prohibition being imposed, which is what the situation we are here in the UK. And I think a combination of tobacco harm reduction policies with a move towards more restrictive policies, if not de facto prohibition, then more restrictive policies that make the most harmful tobacco products less available, less attractive to smokers, is something that we should be thinking about. And I just acknowledge the whole stack of people, the names of people who've contributed to this work, particularly Coral Gardner and Jan Brandrick in a lot of the modelling work, Teo Voss and Angela Wallace as well, and colleagues in the tobacco control community who wouldn't necessarily endorse everything I've said here today. Thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot, Wayne. That really proved.